Welcome to the Future Thinkers Podcast, episode number 42. Today on the show we have Daniel Schmachtenberger, the co-founder and director of research and development for Neurohacker Collective, which is a smart drug company with a vision of advanced human optimization. Daniel's past work involved being a dean for a college of mind-body medicine and running a think tank that focused on developing complex system solutions to environmental and societal issues. We already interviewed Daniel on our podcast once before, where he talked about complex global systems, and you can listen to that episode by going to futurethinkers.org/36. But today our topic is neurohacking, or the voluntary altering of your own brain function to optimize for performance, well-being, or a number of other factors. And we recently got our hands on Qualia, which is a neuroenhancer or a smart drug stack from Neurohacker Collective, which Daniel is the co-founder of. We've tried a few other smart drugs before, like modafinil, for example, but Qualia seems to be quite different from the others. For example, my experience of modafinil was that it made me just dislike people in general, although it made me extremely focused. But Qualia didn't have any of those side effects for me. It gave me a sense of emotional well-being and a general sense of balance as well as focus, which was quite interesting. The term for this is broad-spectrum cognitive enhancement, which means that it doesn't just improve one quality of your functioning, but multiple qualities at the same time. Qualia specifically focuses on three areas of enhancement: cognitive, psychoaffective, and physiological. Cognitive area includes things like intelligence and creativity. Psychoaffective area includes increasing confidence, willpower, and empathy. And physiological area includes higher levels of energy, awareness, and responsiveness. Qualia has also been designed with an ethical mindset. Instead of depleting or overriding your brain's natural function like some other smart drugs, it works to support and enhance without creating dependency. There are over 40 active ingredients in Qualia, and it's all transparent. You can check all of it out on their website. And there's 40 plus years of international research on neurotropic stack formulation behind these ingredients. If you're interested in learning more about Qualia, go to futurethinkers.org/brainhack. One word.
And finally, before we get into the show, I just want to give a quick thank you to our patrons and donors, Josh, Alfred, Lauren, and Melanie. Thank you guys for supporting the show. We love you. To check out the show notes from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/42, and the second half of this interview will be at futurethinkers.org/43 once it's live. And to listen to our first interview with Daniel, go to futurethinkers.org/36. Enjoy the show. Hey, and welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to futurethinkers.org/start.
Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
Upgrade your mental operating system, increase your personal sovereignty, and gain deeper self-knowledge with our courses in personal evolution. Register now at courses.futurethinkers.org. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media.
Daniel, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on again.
I'm happy to be on again.
So your last episodes were quite popular, but we talked about quite a different set of subjects. And today we'd like to talk with you about neurohacking. So maybe can you give us like a brief introduction to what neurohacking is and why we should be doing it, if we should be doing it?
Yeah, so neurohacking is a broad and kind of ambiguous term related to biohacking and consciousness hacking. Generally, we can think of it as the application of any tools or technologies or processes to modulate, augment, upgrade some aspect of psychological, neurological function. And so we could think of ancient neurohacking technologies being meditation and sweat lodges and psychedelics and dancing around the campfire to get into trance-like states and et cetera. And obviously with advances in neuroscience and neurotechnology, we've got QEG, neurofeedback, we've got transcranial stimulation technologies, we've got much more advanced microbiomic, genomic, you know, biochemical technologies. So we can think of neurohacking as how do we optimize the mind-brain interface towards any positive purpose, utilizing whatever tools best serve that particular purpose.
I love how you say mind-brain interface as if they're very separate things.
Well, the reason that we're saying mind-brain interface together is because if you want to run the analogy of mind stuff as kind of like software and brain stuff as kind of like hardware, you realize that the distinction, the clear distinction in computers between software and hardware, we don't have such a clear distinction in the human organism, that any change in thought has a physical change in the brain that's happening. Any physical change in the brain has some change in thinking, emotion, experience, etc. And so they are dynamically co-interaffecting each other all the time.
So I suppose a lot of the thinking that we've done about consciousness has come from, well, it's come from a lot of different perspectives, but the one that we land on quite often is the perspective from Hinduism and Buddhism, which is you are not the mind and the consciousness is not exactly localized in physical material in the brain. So do you have much to say from that perspective before we dive deeper into neurohacking?
Yeah, so we get right into what's famously known in neuroscience as the hard problem of neuroscience. How does consciousness and brain, right, or in general, consciousness and physics, how do they, what are they both, and how do they relate? And is there causal interaction in both directions? This is the hard problem of neuroscience. But before that, this was, you know, the kind of hard problem of the mind-brain problem, or the dualism challenge that all philosophic systems faced, is it seems like there is third person stuff, right, that we can all independently measure. And science is the method of knowing the third person reality, what we think of as third person or objective reality. We can all measure it, we can corroborate it. And if we're going to, you know, make hypotheses about interactional dynamics, we'll be able to, you know, make predictions, et cetera. And third person stuff has weight and position and charge and length and spin and those kinds of properties. First person stuff doesn't have any of those, right? It has emotion and feeling and longing and impulse, and it can't be corroborated by anybody else at all, right? Like, you are having a first person experience as we're talking, and I can empathetically imagine into, feel into what your experience is like. But that is different than actually having the first person access to it that you do. So that both of these realities exist has been acknowledged, and there are philosophic systems that don't think that they're both real, right? You have what are called idealism systems that say consciousness is fundamentally real because it's the only thing we can know. I can know that I'm having an experience, but I can't know that what I'm experiencing about the world, even through my scientific measurements, is true, because I could just be a crazy person, right? This could all be a dream. It could all be the Matrix, and it could just be, you know, contours within consciousness. But I only have first person experience, first person access to my experience of stuff, not the stuff itself. And so in those models, what's fundamentally real is consciousness, and the rest of the universe, right, third person stuff, is either not real at all, Maya, or it's an epiphenomena of consciousness. Mind creates reality. You've got the other side and says, what's fundamentally real is physical stuff, material stuff, physical stuff, happened with the Big Bang, interactions occur that lead to complexity, emergent properties happen out of complexity, and somewhere around biology or maybe nervous systems, consciousness is an emergent property, but what's fundamentally real is physical stuff. And then consciousness is either just not real at all, it's called radical eliminativism, so Dan Dennett and others kind of propose that, it's kind of like an illusion, or consciousness is real, but it's an epiphenomena of complex neural networks, right? Radical emergentism. So you've got different philosophic systems that don't see both of those as fundamentally real things, or reduce them to the domain that seems more real to them, or they're stuck with, all right, these both seem real and they seem uncommensurate, called dualism, or attempts to try and reconcile them more deeply. And so when you're living your life, when your body is touched, interacted with, sensation happens. This is physical, right? It's being mediated via biology and physics, and yet you have a conscious experience. So it seems like physics can affect consciousness. There is a causal movement. But you also experience yourself having some choice. And again, we get deep into not just the topic of consciousness, but the topic of will and volition. And if your choice is real and then affects your hand moving, it would seem that consciousness has some effect on physics. And there, for every branch where you say, well, what about that? And each of these questions, each of these things I've said and the questions that come up, there is a whole branch of philosophy that goes down. Is there really free will or not? Is it compatible with a deterministic universe or not? Is universe deterministic, et cetera? But most of what we're going to talk about today does not require these deep existential issues being solved to say that we do know empirically, both first person and third person, that the things that we can do with our subjective experience, so mindfulness, meditation, introspection, et cetera, can actively affect the brain and affect the brain in ways that affect the mind's predispositions, and things that we can do to the body, i.e. changing its biochemistry, changing its microbiota, exercising differently, change cognitive and emotional, right, mental, and the experience of the conscious creature. Now you can abstract and say, well, okay, so you're saying the mind, thinking, feeling stuff is different than the body. Is consciousness different than that, as the non-dual witness you mentioned, kind of the Hindu Buddhist philosophy? So maybe there is consciousness as a field effect that is then interacting with this self-organizing system. Fascinating questions, and if you wanted to do a show where we just dive into them, the existential questions at depth, I'd be happy.
I think that's the plan for the next one, actually.
Yeah, cool.
But yeah, you bring up non-duality, and that's exactly what I was going to say just now. Do you approach neurohacking from a non-dualistic perspective, where it's both ascending and descending in terms that Ken Wilber uses?
Yeah, so when Ken talks about the ascending paths, he's talking about the transcendent direction and the descending paths, the immanent direction, right? So the transcendent spiritual processes are around, in some way, having consciousness leave body, mind, etc., and go into higher states of witnessing universal consciousness, etc. The descending paths are around taking universal consciousness and embodying it more fully. And if you just want to talk about it very simply in terms of just having expanded states of awareness and then being able to integrate those expanded states as integrated stages, yes, that's a valuable way to think about it.
Cool. So why don't we move into the actual subject of neurohacking? You talked about the different tools that we can use. What are some of the currently available tools for neurohacking?
Well, so there's a lot of different goals, right? And so if someone's wanting to decrease anxiety or brighten their mood or increase their cognitive function or have altered kind of, you know, psychedelic numinous states or improve their sleep quality, or each of these goals are going to have different tools that are more appropriate. And then each of the goals are going to have different tools that are different depending upon the person and what the person actually has going on, their specific biochemistry, genomics, etc. So I'll speak broadly about categories of tools that are currently available, and then we can get into applications more. So think about first affecting the brain and body. And this is another important distinction. So we look at the intersection between the mind and brain, but it's not just mind and brain. It's your conscious experience and your body as a whole. And then we could say, well, it's actually the mind, brain, body, environment complex, because the environment and the body are interacting each other inexorably in real time. So these are embedded complex systems. But let's just talk about the topic of embodied consciousness and conscious experience that is mediated beyond just the nervous system in the physiology. You know, the first example that I think people are getting pretty popularly aware of is the gut-brain axis. And the gut-brain axis is mediated via a number of things. You've got the enteric nervous system, which is a whole branch of peripheral nervous system in the intestines, where inflammation in the intestines can cause imbalance between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, can cause neuroinflammation, etc. But you've also got the microbiome digesting food, and actually many of our nutrients are metabolic byproducts of the microbiota. And obviously we evolved with our microbiome over so many generations before we had chlorinated water and antibiotics and refined sugar diets. And so the human genome doesn't actually code everything necessary to make a human. The genome codes a bunch of stuff, but we got a genome and a microbiome from our parents. And the baby's microbiome comes some in utero, some from the vaginal flora, some from, you know, breastfeeding. But if we damage that, a whole bunch of functions necessary to make an optimum human can be damaged. So specifically regarding nervous system, some of the main neurotransmitters like GABA, dopamine, serotonin, are primarily produced via flora in the intestines. And so for each of those three I just mentioned, somewhere between 30 to 80% of those neurotransmitters are actually produced in the gut. And then, you know, move to the brain. If you think about losing 30 to 80% of your serotonin or GABA or dopamine, that's, you know, psychopathology, right? That's a messed up brain. So then you start looking at, well, how many people are eating food that is feeding some microbes more than others and changing the gut microbiome or have some GI disturbance? And so it's important that if we helped the microbiome of someone's gut, that's a neurohack, right? We can be changing their brain chemistry, the most critical kinds of signaling chemicals, by changing the bacteria in their gut. The same is true if we want to look at, say, pain anywhere in the body. Pain can create inflammation that can cross the blood-brain barrier and cause neural inflammation and create depression and cognitive issues. Exercise, certain types of exercise can actually affect genetic transcription and change endogenous biochemical patterns in the brain. And so, you know, we'll talk about technologies to affect the brain and nervous system directly, but some of them are technologies to affect the environment that the brain and nervous system lives in, which is first order the body, right? So tools. Let's think about biochemical tools. So first line of biochemical tools is things that you can put in your mouth, right? So we're talking about vitamins and supplements and herbs and drugs, et cetera. So you've got anxiolytic biochemistry, things that can decrease anxiety. You've got things that can help with sleep. You've got things that can help with cognition, all the nootropics and smart drugs. And then, you know, you've got things that can create experiences that might not be where you want to live all the time, but are meaningful state experiences. So let's take psychedelics and say, all right, are we optimizing the physiology by taking a psychedelic, or are we augmenting it, moving it into a specific range of function that we might not want to live in all the time, but that has very meaningful positive effects lastingly if done properly? So you've got, you can just think about all the biochemical stuff, right? Now then you've got biochemical stuff that could be injected, could go intranasally. There's a lot of different delivery methods for biochemical technologies for neurohacking. You've got the biological technologies, which, like we were mentioning, you know, affecting the microbiome of the gut, but not just the microbiome of the gut, the microbiome of all of the mucosa systems of the body. It's pretty common for people to have infections in their mouth, subclinical dental infections or subclinical nasal infections that are actually releasing biotoxins that affect the brain. And so they are the boundary between good integrative functional medicine and neurohacking, right? That kind of blurs. We've got genomic therapies we can think about for neurohacking. So, you know, we're at the edge of starting to think about CRISPR and looking at, do people with higher IQs, do people that are happier or more depressed have different genomic patterns, and can we actually do gene doping, splicing, et cetera, to affect that? And even before looking at it at a genomic level, we look at a genetic expression level. Can we turn on or off or modulate certain gene expressions? And there's a bunch of things that do that. And then to the degree that we know someone has, say, a bunch of mutations on their MAO branches or their COMT branches that code for certain neurotransmitter predispositions, can we at least just do nutrigenomics, right? Provide different nutrients for them to bypass where they have genomic deficiencies. You've got so many fun technologies. You've got biofeedback and specifically neurofeedback, EEG neurofeedback, which can provide input about the brain to the brain that it doesn't normally get, that teaches it how to regulate much more profoundly and quickly in many areas. We've got all the transcranial technologies. So we can stimulate the brain with transcranial lasers, transcranial direct current or alternating current, transcranial magnets or ultrasound. Ultrasound has some fascinating studies and early studies in curing Alzheimer's right now. T TMS has had some great work in depression, and some of the TDCS has been used for hyperclocking the prefrontal cortex. So there's a bunch of fun things in there. The transcranial lasers, low-level laser, not just transcranial, but sometimes they'll go up your nose. Intranasal lasers can increase ATP production in the neurons, so increase mitochondrial output. That's a good example. If you're increasing ATP output, you're not making the system more moved in a stimulatory direction, right? You're not affecting stimulating neurotransmitters or neurohormones. You're also not doing neuroinhibitory ones. You're just increasing the cell energy for it to do whatever it wants to do better, which is kind of like a younger brain.
Interesting.
There's a bunch more, but give me more questions. Otherwise, I'll keep going.
So you brought up the gut brain. Is there a feedback mechanism that you can train yourself to pay attention to so that you have better insight or thinking sort of informed by the gut?
So we could take this a couple different ways. We could say that we might be actually looking at the information processing of the enteric nervous system, right? That there is this gut brain, gut nervous system, that it provides a different kind of input or feedback, just like there's a bunch of neurons in the heart, and we could talk about the heart as an information processing system, you know, or the neurons in it at least. That might be true. I don't think we know enough to know for sure. We can also, though, just talk about the benefit of tuning into different perspectives and being able to get different information. So let me give you a totally different example. Napoleon Hill's famous book, Think and Grow Rich. So he said that one of his favorite practices that he developed in there was he had this council of invisible advisors. And his invisible advisors were, he thought about who he wanted to become and the qualities that mattered most. And he thought about people that really represented embodying that quality well. And so maybe he didn't want to become Genghis Khan, you know, holistically, but there was some aspect of courage that he wanted Genghis Khan's insight for. And so he had, you know, he had his list, the Lincoln, Da Vinci, Ford, whoever, I don't remember whose exact list was, but he studied those people well enough that he could have some real sense of their personalities. And then he would convene seeing them all at a council table with his eyes closed in a kind of meditative state. And then he would bring life issues to them and ask for their feedback and go around and have Lincoln talk, right? Then have Napoleon talk. And one of the things that he found was that when he was asking for Gandhi's input, he got insight that he would have never got just journaling his own thoughts. And he said, all right, so is it because I am channeling Gandhi, or is it simply because I'm looking at the universe through a different lens that I wouldn't normally using my own brain? And, you know, he said, let's assume that it's the latter, but it really doesn't matter at all. The net result is profound, valuable, useful, empirically useful insights came from looking at the world through those lenses. You can do the same thing with parts of your body. And it's actually a really meaningful part of somatic psychology. So you can tune into your gut. You could tune into, say you want to use the chakra system, right? And you tune into your solar plexus or your heart chakra, your throat chakra. Does it matter if there are really chakras? No, it doesn't matter at all. Does it matter if the chakras correlate to nerve plexes or to endocrine glands or if they're nonsense? Is you're just tuning in to this part of your body and saying, what does it want to tell me? What does it think? What does it, you know, want me to know? And some information comes, and then you step back in your normal state of consciousness and look at that. Might you be able to gain meaningful insights from it? Definitely.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of looking at it, because some people, you know, if they're not used to, or if they don't believe that, you know, chakras exist, they might just refuse to use the technique. But actually, the way you put it, you can totally just use the technique without having any kind of belief about it. Does this work? Yes, it does. Does it not work? Okay, well, maybe I can try something else.
And, you know, it doesn't have to just be chakras. It's just an example. You could just take an area of your body that's hurting and tune in and say, what is this part want me to know? Maybe you don't get anything, but then you just kind of feel the pain and you, or the tension or whatever it is, and you say, all right, if this pain could talk, what would it say? And you see what comes up. It's interesting how often that ends up being insightful. And when we talk about the mind-brain interface or the mind-body interface, there are a tremendous number of places where the top-down regulatory system has huge effects on all the other systems. And so where specifically emotions, psychology, end up affecting physiology. When you think about why does a placebo ever make anything better for anybody, right? Like it doesn't even make sense why a placebo, like why isn't the body already healing at its optimum capacity as it is, since it would be genetically programmed to do so. And it is already healing at its optimum capacity, and taking the sugar pill isn't interesting. And it's not even the belief that's interesting. It's when someone is in, say someone has a disease state, they're anxious about it, and that anxious is mediated by cortisol and epinephrine and et cetera. And so their cortisol is taking the precursor hormone pregnenolone and shunting it into cortisol in the adrenals, which means less of it's going to DHEA. So the cortisol DHEA ratio gets higher. Well, that ends up affecting everything from genetic transcription to lean muscle mass to bone density to so many things. So then when the person believes they're going to get well and they feel better and their stress drops and their parasympathetic nervous system can kick on and their sympathetic nervous system chills out and their cortisol DHEA ratio moves in the right direction, the actual reparative mechanisms of physiology are more available to them. And so their body is healing as best as it can in the stress state, and in a non-stress state, it can actually heal better, right? Now, one of the interesting things is it's placebo is not the only thing that can do that. You look at work like Norman Cousins' work where he just watched comedy because he thought he was dying of cancer, and his cancer got better not because he believed he was going to get better but because he was not stressed out and he was happy for the first time, and it ended up being that stress was meaningful to – you know, the process of pathology that was going on for him. And so this doesn't mean that it's the only thing or that it will always be affecting. Sometimes placebo just affects how you sense something, but not the underlying pathophysiology, but it's a part of it. So when you tune into pain in the body, for instance, or tension in the body, is it possible that there is some psychological connection that's happening there where you can gain insights? Often.
Are there other ways of affecting cortisol in your body that are meaningful in the long term, other than this kind of observing your body and releasing it consciously?
Oh, yeah. So this is like the first place that functional medicine doctors and naturopathic doctors talk to people, which is understanding how the HPA axis works and that the dysregulation in the HPA axis usually starts at the A, at the adrenal side, and that roughly you can say the sympathetic nervous system innervates the adrenal cortex, and the primary hormone, there's many coming from that process, is cortisol, and the parasympathetic nervous system innervates the adrenal medulla, and there are, again, many hormones that are coming out, but the primary one is DHEA. So the ratio of cortisol to DHEA as hormones in the endocrine system in the blood, representing kind of systemic effects, is roughly equivalent to the sympathetic-parasympathetic ratio of the system as a whole, and, you know, related to chronic stress. So in early phases of chronic stress, cortisol goes up, and the precursor to cortisol in the brain, ACTH, goes up. After that's been the case for a little while, DHEA starts to go down because cortisol and DHEA are both made from the same precursor hormone called pregnenolone, and it's a rate-limited hormone. There's a finite amount of it. After a while, if someone stays in chronic stress, cortisol starts to drop too, simply because the adrenal glands are fatigued, and now DHEA is way lower. So you can see people in high or low cortisol adrenal stress states, depending upon how long they are in that pathology. But so you can give someone bioidentical hormones or things that support hormones to get them in the right range quickly and make the person feel better. So say you do a blood or a salivary hormone lab to look at adrenals, you can do that. But the big thing is just going to be dropping the stress load. And the stress load is psychological and physiologic stresses. So too much sugar in an unstable blood sugar cycle causes cortisol spiking. Body reads it as stress, kind of continuous starvation cycle responses. Not enough sleep is a huge cause of stress. both not enough exercise or exercising in a way that's causing injury. So you've got, and as well as toxins and pathogens that cause inflammation. So all of those can cause chronic stress, as well as all the psychological sources. So one of the, you know, you can say that the first good part of neurohacking is just health, right? Health and well-being, because so many people are dealing with brain fog or low-level anxiety, depression before they seek to optimize beyond baseline. Just getting back to baseline is pretty great. So identifying the things that took them below baseline and reversing those, that should be the foundational stuff.
Right. I think so many people neglect that. They're trying to kind of go to superhuman levels rather than just trying to optimize for what's missing or for what's kind of below normal levels. So what else is in that spectrum of what people often overlook? We've talked about cortisol. We've talked about the gut microbiome. Are there any other important components of this equation?
Sure. This is not the sexy part. This is the, like, fucking don't tell us about this stuff again part, but it's just, it's critical. And then the sexy part is the stuff that seems like magic bullets that make you have superhero powers. So we'll get more into that at the end, but those parts really do. There are some really neat, exciting technologies that can be very powerfully augmenting, but they really do function radically better in a well-tuned system than an already dysregulated system. Doesn't mean they can't help to get you back to function in a dysregulated system, but we really want to be functioning on foundational well-being. So first category is sleep. I say this because it ends up affecting more categories of health and psychology faster than almost anything else. And it's something that is just so easy for most of us to do a poor job with. By sleep, I mean both enough sleep and good quality sleep. So even, you know, it's give or take a third of your life, but it's like 90% of all the repair that happens to your physiology. And you've got some very meaningful information consolidation, psychological consolidation happening in dreams and theta, but almost all the physiologic repair happens in delta. It's also where the memory consolidation happens. So making sure that we're getting enough delta sleep, I would say, is a huge foundation. Now, we've got neurohacks for helping that. You can, one should make sure that the foundational things are in place so that environmentally, do you have a good sleeping environment? Do you have a good bed? Is it dark? Is it quiet? Good air quality? You're not in a room with mold or VOC, et cetera, and you don't have people or dogs or whatever waking you up throughout the night. You could do a whole show just on how to make an optimized sleeping environment. And it's a pretty important thing, factoring how big a deal it is. And then there are definitely supplements that people can take that will help them sleep better depending upon what's wrong with their sleep. But if they're not sleeping well because they're waking up to pee a lot versus they're snoring, right, those really need addressed in different ways. But addressing them is really important.
There's also the amount of light that you receive before sleep. So many people stay on their phone right before they go to bed, and that can have really terrible implications because your brain doesn't produce enough melatonin.
Yeah, so cortisol and melatonin are in a circadian rhythm with each other, where cortisol is high in the day, low at night, melatonin's low in the day, high at night, and it's a light-stimulated cycle. And so it's actually important to get enough bright light during the day. If you don't and your cortisol doesn't actually go high, then it won't come low enough and give you good sleep at night. But it is important to avoid bright and blue light before bed. So you see a lot of people wear blue blocking glasses or put the Flux app on their computer to take it out of the blue range, you know, things like that. In general, I would say a wind down routine before bed where you stop taking in stressful things. You stop the blue and the bright light, and you start preparing body and mind for sleep, whether it's through a bath or the right kind of reading or stretching. Super useful. We're working on some technologies, some biochemical technologies that induce better delta sleep, a number of different ones. One of the ones that we're most excited about is a new kind of brain inductions called phase-locked induction. And this was a a DARPA-funded project originally with some people that were partnered with out of University of Northwestern. And rather than try to induce delta waves, like using binaural beats or strobe lights or transcranial stim, these researchers recognize that the brain actually resists having its brain wave patterns changed externally pretty strongly, because its own process for regulating the frequency that it's in, which is the opening and closing of the ion gates, is very, very sensitive. It's controlled by many factors. And it's really only susceptible to induction when the gates are open, when the ion channels are open. And so they put EEG on people's head, found out when the people went into delta sleep. They were specifically trying to improve the efficiency of delta sleep. And then exactly when the gates were open, they put in a stimulus for the exact same wave pattern, the same frequency that the brain was in, where it was crest-crest aligned. So they weren't changing the brain wave pattern. They were just adding more of the exact brain wave pattern that the brain was in to add amplitude, which the hypothesis was would increase the efficiency of everything that was happening, because you get more net communication per unit time happening. And this happened. And so the first studies that were done on memory, and they found a 400% increase in long-term memory in healthy adults after a week of using this technology. And that's testing memory, but if delta sleep is going up, that's going to be helping anxiety, it's going to be decreasing risk for Alzheimer's, it's going to be affecting oxidation and anti-inflammation. So this technology is not far from being market ready. This is an example of like really fun neural hacks that we're right on the brink of.
That is so interesting. It sounds like it's almost tricking the brain into thinking that it's doing a better job at whatever it's already doing than it actually is. And I wonder if it has a feedback loop where the brain picks up that, oh, this is really working, and then it knows how it arrived there because it was already doing that, maybe just to a smaller degree, and then it already knows how to do that and it does it better next time. Is that the case?
So there are some therapies where after you do them, the brain continues to do them on its own because it learns how to do them. That's kind of the exact opposite of the way we usually think of, say, psychopharmacology drugs, right? Which is that they create dependence and addiction. You get off of them and your brain can't do that anymore because it overrode the natural regulatory system. This is one of our primary design principles, is that we want to understand what the brain's own regulatory process and the body's regulatory process is doing and support it rather than override it, in a way that whenever someone stops with that particular technology, you have a net neutral to net positive lasting effect rather than a down regulation and dependence. I would say good neurohacking in general should have that as one of its criteria. With this particular one, I don't think a study has been done yet on someone using it for a while and then stopping and seeing if they continue to get that elevation from baseline. I wouldn't see it as much as that it's trying to trick the brain as it is supporting it by adding energy, right? Like if there's three people pushing a car and one more person comes along to push, it just goes better because there is, you know, more force being added to what's already happening. And so here the goal was, as the brain is modulating its frequency and it's at the max amplitude that it can generate, if we can just add energy, so we're adding amplitude, we're just going to increase the efficiency of its process. There's something very beautiful, right? There's something very Aikido about not, we know what the brain should be doing better and we're going to try and induce this specific frequency of delta, but we actually don't know why it is moving between the frequencies exactly the way that it does, but we're going to kind of trust it and follow it and just add resource. I think stem cells is another way that you can think about that, right? As you think about stem cell therapy, we don't know how the stem cells differentiate into tissues fully and then all the metabolic functions that those cells do, but we're simply adding resource to the system. In general, I think the approach to support the system's own regulatory processes doing what they do better, as opposed to trying to override them, is a key distinction in how we should approach tech interface with the body.
Interesting. And so when it comes to supplements, is this also your approach? that you're trying to support what the body is already doing rather than kind of installing a new program. Oh, this is how you're going to do it, body. Okay.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, like with the supplements that we've developed and more that we're in process of developing. So let's take Qualia as an example. It's a nootropic product, cognitive enhancement product that we made because there's a good example here. So some of the ingredients are actually just nutrients, right? They're nutrients that you should get in food. And if you're eating a healthy diet, you'll be getting more of them than not. But they're nutrients that either are very commonly deficient, even in good diets, for a number of reasons. So certain trace minerals that are important for brain function, they're just deficient in soil. Even organic soil is still very different than before the soil originally went through a bunch of monocropping. And plants can't make minerals, right? They're going to pull up the minerals that are in the soil. Similarly, if the soil is deficient in microbiota, it's going to affect the plant chemistry if the plant's been hybridized. So if there are common deficiencies in certain nutrients that are necessary for cognitive capacity or sleep or something like that, making sure that there's enough of them, that's just augmenting eating. And that doesn't mean that you can then eat poorly, right? That's why we use the word supplement, right? Is that it is to supplement, to be in addition to. Because what someone takes a few grams of in pills compared to what they're taking like pounds of in food, there's no way that that's going to replace the primary effect. But it can meaningfully add to it. But also, just like if someone is going to be using some function a lot more than an evolutionary environment would have had them use that function, right? So if athletically someone's going to be sweating a lot more, they're going to lose electrolytes faster. So we give them electrolytes and it actually makes a difference. Or they're going to be using branched chain amino acids to build skeletal muscle more if they're tearing down skeletal muscle. So we supplement branched chain aminos. There are nutrients that get used faster when someone is in certain kinds of cognitive process. So if they want to spend a lot of time in peak cognitive process, they're going to burn through those quicker. So you want to supplement them. It's brain nutrients. And that is just the body's going to convert those. So say the amino acids that can get converted to neurotransmitters, the vitamins and minerals that are involved in the conversion process, the body's going to convert them as it needs them, but you're not going to have nutrition be a rate limiting factor. So that's obviously working with endogenous pathway support. There are other things where, say, we are looking at the acetylcholine pathway. It has a lot to do with memory and learning and sensory motor function, speed of neuronal communication. So the body's producing acetylcholine. It's moving across synapses. It's getting received in the postsynaptic receptors. We can give plants or chemicals that modulate that process, but that modulate the process in a much more holistic way than, say, traditional psychopharmacologic approaches, which is a single drug intervention that's going to affect one part, right? Like Adderall being a presynaptic dopamine agonist and then not necessarily looking at how that works within the whole dopamine cycle and how dopamine relates to norepinephrine and epinephrine and serotonin and the whole rest of neurotransmission. So we want to look at, if we're going to affect a neurotransmitter, we want to look at the entire cycle of that transmitter. We want to look at the cellular processes of the pre- and postsynaptic neuron, and we want to look at all the other transmitters and signaling chemicals that it's in relationship with and make sure that we're actually supporting a holistic process, right? And so you've got to factor, if you're wanting to be able to run more acetylcholine through the system, the body's ability to acetylate the choline so that you have enough acetyl group, you have choline, certain source of choline can go to the peripheral neuron or to the central nervous system. So depending upon what you want to do, you do that differently. And then there are, you know, rate limiting cofactors. Like for that one, it happens to be B5. So you want to make sure that's not going to be rate limiting. But then the acetylcholine getting across the synapse, you have enzymes that are breaking it down, just like you have enzymes that are breaking down dopamine or serotonin. So, you know, many of the pharmaceutical meds that affect transmitter levels are working by modulating what's happening in the synaptic cleft, right? Reuptake inhibitor. So if someone has genetically high MAO levels or COMT levels or acetylcholine esterase levels, then they're going to be subfunctional in that area and you can actually be able to, you know, have a nutrigenomic override to that. And if you're going to be producing more acetylcholine and you want it to get across the synapse, so you're going to, you know, help with acetylcholine esterase inhibitors, and then you actually want to get it uptaken in the postsynaptic neuron, right? So the NMDA receptors primarily, there are things that you can use that will modulate that receptor. If you support the entire cycle of how the body is actually producing it, you'll get a lot more optimum results, and you'll end up getting the body learning how to do that and being able to actually have plasticity effect, right? It's going to rewire to that state if it does that state a significant amount. And then when someone gets off it, they'll either have little effect or lasting positive effects because they have rewired. One of the bigger ways that you get lasting effects is by actually working to change brain structure in a positive direction. So this is things like, can we help the brain develop more new neurons and increase gray matter density or develop more new synapses? So it's called neurogenesis or synaptogenesis. So we get more densely interconnected brain structures. And there do happen to be a lot of things that are known about specific nutrients and specific chemicals that do support the brain's natural process of neurogenesis happening more robustly, or the brain's process of neurotophagy, killing old senescent brain cells that cause problems and allowing new ones to, you know, proliferate. And so these are examples of ways you could get lasting benefit after, you know, from a biochemical solution, after stopping taking the biochemical solution, because it's actually seeking to, one, just tune the system better, and two, rewire to an upregulated state, and three, actually support the development of new structures.
This is really interesting. I wanted to rewind slightly to where you're talking about neurotransmitters that regulate mood, because there's a huge industry of selling drugs that regulate mood that actually have adverse long-term effects. If you stop taking them, or if you continue taking them, they kind of lose their effectiveness in a way over time. And for example, I have experience taking SSRIs, and I had both of those effects with withdrawal after coming off of them and decreasing effectiveness over time. But what you're talking about is that it's actually possible to have supplements or drugs that have net positive effects over time, even if you stop taking them. Can you talk about that a bit specifically when it comes to mood regulation?
Yeah, so let me say that the ideal way to approach this is a personalized medicine or personalized well-being approach, because so say the SSRI did some good for you for a while, but then it had side effects and it had down regulation and you adapted to it. Did it do some good for you because you actually had a dysbiosis issue in your gut where you just were not producing half of the serotonin that you need? That's an important question, right? Because if so, I wouldn't even want to give you brain supplements. I'd want to fix your gut. Or was there actually something where your diet was deficient in tryptophan, and so the raw amino acid necessary to make serotonin was low, and we just actually had to address your diet, right? Or so there's so many things that can be involved, and we can say in general, if someone takes 5-HTP, which is 5-hydroxytryptophan, hydroxylated tryptophan, that's just one conversion step away from 5-hydroxytryptamine, which is serotonin, and they take the phosphorylated version of B6, P5P, that it converts the 5-HTP to serotonin, that they're much, since that's just the stuff that is one step away from serotonin the body be working with anyways, that they're less likely to get dependence and downregulation from just having enough of those things than they would from an SSRI. That's true. And ideally, I would find out what's going on first, because, you know, we also see so many people who they get on an SSRI and then they get much worse, right? So many of the shooting cases that we've seen were after someone was put on an SSRI who hadn't been on it before, and the suicidal, homicidal tendencies are true, because if someone is more dopamine deficient in their depression and they really needed something like Wellbutrin instead, like, this is what's so crazy to me, is we don't even do any kind of testing to see that there's a neurochemical imbalance before we give them chemistry rather than psychology. And then to the degree that there even is a neurochemical imbalance, we don't know which one or which ones. And then to the degree that we even knew which one, we don't know why it's off. And the answer is just straight to a drug.
Yeah.
That's just crazy.
It is. And think about this. So your brain is as complex a system as we know of existing in universe, right? And you've got the number of neurons and of glial cells and the number of synaptic connections and the number of metabolic processes per individual one, and the feedback and feedforward processes is just completely mind-boggling. So when you think about something like serotonin, right, that is a it's a signaling molecule that's the end of many steps of metabolic transform. So if it's low, how likely is it that other things are low or high or dysregulated or there's something else off? Like, it's pretty high, right? When we just go straight to let's give more serotonin, right? Let's keep it from, you know, reuptake. And because we have to, you know, in the drug industry has to use synthetic single molecules to be able to get them patented, which is the only way that they could ever make enough money to go through FDA trials. And that's FDA, but every country has, you know, some version of it. I think US probably leads the way in some of both the good and bad aspects of this. What's the chance that a single synthetic molecule, meaning it's not part of your natural landscape at all and it's just one molecule, could ever be an adequate solution to a complex chemistry dysregulation in a self-organizing system like your brain? Like, it just doesn't even make sense, right? It doesn't make sense that that could possibly be the thing that's really going to repair it.
Yeah.
So it's usually going to be not one molecule that's off, but lots of them. And so then we have to, from maybe lots of different processes. So how do we identify what's going on and support the systems increasing its own internal resilience? I mean, the same as like when you talk about cognitive chemistry. Is cognitive chemistry mediated via dopamine or via acetylcholine or glutamate or sodium ion channels or long-term potentiation or all those things, right? Complex interactions and lots of those things. And so one of the key things is that when you're wanting to work with a complex system like a brain, you've really got to have a more complexity-informed approach than single molecule interventions.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying we're mostly involved in this single molecule interventions because that's what's profitable?
It's not just that's what's profitable. That's the only thing that you can, because it's profitable, it's the only thing you can even afford to do research on.
Right.
You know, when you hear things like, well, there are not so many good scientific trials done on herbs, who the fuck would pay for them? I mean, you'll see little trials done on herbs, but it costs $1 billion, give or take, to take a drug through FDA approval. Well, who's going to put in $1 billion? And then when you take the drug through, you're not even sure that it's going to work in the market. And then you have a class action lawsuit at the end. Like, you've got to have a $20 billion potential on that for it to make any sense to even embark on, right?
Wow.
So, of course, you've got to have a patent on it. And so if you have something that's not patentable, and even in the drug space, there are certain drugs that got published about in a way that makes them unpatentable. And even though they're super promising, they just don't get developed because who would develop them?
Right, because if it's not a synthetic chemical, if it's already available in nature, they probably can't patent it. For example, in my case, I've been using Peganum harmala seeds for mood regulation, and I've had really excellent effects with them, much, much better than I ever had with SSRIs, also combined with meditation and diet adjustments. But, you know, if something like that was patented as a mood regulation supplement, they probably couldn't patent it.
Well, no, they definitely can't patent it, but even some synthetics can't get patented because, you know, the information was already released and so now it's part of the commons, or after the patent life on a drug expires and so now it's not really profitable because the generics are all going to be really cheap, then we need to, for a drug company, look for a new thing in that space, even if the new things are not better or even shittier than the previous things, simply because we just can't make money doing that.
So what are the ways around it?
Supplements don't have to go through FDA approval. Think about from pharmaceutical industry, what it means to invest something like $1 billion of capital before you've made your first dollar back. right? Like, that's so far from Silicon Valley software tech thinking. That's a lot of money to invest before, you know, actually having any revenue. But yeah, so supplements, they don't have to do that, but they can't claim that they have any medical purpose or heal anything. So then that becomes the tricky thing. If they want to claim it, they have to go through FDA process. If they're going to go through FDA process, that's super expensive, and they're going to have a profit stream to be able to justify it. So that's the deal. Basically, to really fix that, the entire regulatory, financial, and intellectual property structures have to be changed. And realistically, I can say for-profit medicine is a broken system. Because when you have a for-profit sick care system where people come in ill, pharmaceuticals or hospitals or insurance or anybody, you know, any money that's going to be made in the multi-trillion dollar complex of healthcare is only made when people are sick. So prevention would just obsolete that entire profit stream, right? And so then you start thinking about patients as customers, and every MBA, first thing they learn is how do you maximize the lifetime value of a customer? And that should never apply to a patient, right? Theory of markets, of free markets, should apply to things that one can choose into, choose out of. You can't reasonably choose out of healthcare. And so it should not be structured in the for-profit way that it is, any more than for-profit prison should be.
Yeah, you're optimizing for what you don't want.
Exactly. You know, I was talking to a group that was working on peace and reconciliation the other day, and I asked them, what's the chance of having a world free from war or any militarized conflict while having a for-profit military-industrial complex lastingly? And they realized that supply and demand theory says 0% chance that those two could coexist enduringly, right? Because if there isn't demand for that supply, it'll shut down and stop existing. It won't be a for-profit complex, or it will have to do supply-side economics and create demand. And so that means that you have the largest block of economics have its own survival antithetical to global peace. That's a fucked up structure for humanity. And for-profit prisons are the same, and for-profit healthcare is the same. And when you start going through, you see how many places the financial incentive, the game theory, is exactly opposite to what the collective goal should be. So, like, what it takes to really fix medicine and healthcare and well-being care, et cetera, the IP has to change to where we're not focused on patentable things and then separate patents that can't be combined because different IP holders have them and only unnatural things, et cetera. The whole IP process is broken, and it needs to move to maximum innovation, not ownership restriction. The financial models have to change where all the financial incentive is aligned with what we actually want, which is optimize collective well-being, not otherwise. And that doesn't look like any fiscal healthcare system we've had. And the scientific model has to change. Rather than a, you know, small number of variable reductionist approach to understanding a complex self-organizing system, we have to actually get better at complexity science and understanding the body as a regulatory system, the body-mind complex, a regulatory system, what causes regulatory breakdown and how to support increased regulatory capacity of the system rather than just overriding it all the time.
Right. It's a whole different set of incentives.
It's a different kind of science, it's different incentives, and it's different legal structures. And so, yes, there's a lot of things that we want to evolve in diagnostic medicine and therapeutic medicine and in AI interpretation, and you know, but deeper than all that are these meta structures that need to evolve.
So going back to the kind of specific approaches that you are taking, how are you building these meta structures in a different way than they currently exist?
Yeah. So we're obviously within the confines of those meta structures to begin with. So we're our first products are supplements. The reason why we chose to do supplements was to be able to bring things direct to consumer. That's what it's going to be called, rather than to go through FDA process and a doctor process. And specifically, since we're working with some synthetics, but largely, you know, synthetics and natural compounds both, so a lot of unpatentable things, and combinations of them, and you know, moving towards customizable combinations, it's outside of patentability. So for all those reasons, that made sense. And because we wanted to be able to control the integrity of the company, we wanted to take on very little capital and only very values aligned capital. And so we wanted to build things that we could actually build ourselves first to then be able to grow the company and continue. So like, for instance, the first product we brought to market, Qualia, our COGS on it, right? Just our cost of goods is higher than the retail cost of most other cognitive enhancers on the market. And all the investors looked at it and said, well, you got to get the COGS down. I'm like, there is no way to get it down until we get to huge economies of scale and owning our own supply chain without cutting quality, because I run a bunch of additional steps of testing to make sure that there's, you know, optimized purity and potency and that no mycotoxin or whatever got into the supply and manufacturing, and use forms that are more expensive forms of all the ingredients and, you know, amounts that are actually meaningful, which is expensive. So part of it is when you're working within those structures, knowing what your mission is very clearly. So your mission is not delivering returns to shareholders first. It's actually delivering meaningful technology to enrich people's lives. And if you don't have something that'll do that, you just don't do it. That's a really key first part of it, right? And then being able to grow while maintaining control of that mission is a key part of it. How else are we working with those metastructures? Well, we open source our information. So as far as IP, we just don't believe in it. So rather than say we have a proprietary blend of this number of milligrams of things, we just have the exact number of milligrams of the exact sources and all the sourcing info. So if anyone wants to just go buy the raw ingredients and make it themselves, they're welcome to. If someone wants to try and make a better formula, they can, because we just want to support the field advancing for optimized human well-being as best as possible. And so that's we have a strong open source take on everything IP. And then reinvesting our capital in developing new technologies and really focusing on not where is the highest profit margin technology, but what are the technologies that will really make the biggest difference in addressing the things that cause most suffering that are the least well addressed currently.
All right. On this bright and shiny note, we're going to end this episode. We still got an hour left in this interview, but that's going to be in the next episode.
To check out the show notes from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/42. And the second half of this interview will be at futurethinkers.org/43 once it's live. See you in the next one.
Bye.
Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
Upgrade your mental operating system, increase your personal sovereignty, and gain deeper self-knowledge with our courses in personal evolution. Register now at courses.futurethinkers.org. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media.